So the question I'd like to begin by asking you, because you've seen it inside, is how would you describe Shlomo Melech's time period? What was life like when Shlomo was king? Shira.
So it was very, wealthy, rich, well-off, very satisfied, and food for everyone. They were living peacefully.
Amazing. So it's a time of peace and prosperity, mm-hmm. right? It's a time when people are very satisfied with what they had, very happy. They had everything that they needed to eat. They had even beyond that, as we'll discuss in a moment. Yeah.
Also, it seems that the Jews were admired by the other people.
Interesting.
Like,
good. Right? Their name, his name, but because he's our king and he was our representative, their name had gone out to all the other nations and they wanted to come to hear from him. So in particular, I'd like to point out five different areas of abundance that we're told about in Melachim Aleph, because I think that these five specific areas are going to come up again and again. And I wanted to mention them here. So the first thing we're told about there being an abundance of in the time of Shlomo HaMelech is of people, just population size. Right? What are B'nai Yisrael compared to? Sand. In fulfillment of what promise?
Abraham.
Good. The promise that Hashem made to Abraham at Birkan HaBetarim was one in which Hashem promised him that his descendants would be as numerous as the sand of the sea and also of the stars. There are two different comparisons there. And here we see the fulfillment of that promise. Obviously, it's years and years later, which makes sense. But here in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, we begin the description of this time period that Hashem's promise has been fulfilled and that B'nai Yisrael's numbers have exceeded counting. That's how numerous they were. Which is interesting because really pretty much right before this, at the very, very end of Sefer Shmuel, David attempts to count the nation and he's punished for it. And it's interesting that now they're described as being so numerous as, what Hashem promised Abraham, you can't even count the sand. So it's interesting. It's almost like perhaps a rebuke to David, don't even try to count them. You can't. You're not supposed to. Anyway, that was just a thought that popped into my head. I just finished Sefer Shmuel in class, so that was abundance number one, right? The number of people there were in Am Yisrael at the time. Abundance number two that were pointed out is the land itself, the size of the land, right? If you flip actually to page number three, you'll see a map, and just to give you a sense, right, modern day Israel is outlined, it's shaded a little bit darker, it's shaded in a different color, but you can't see that on this copy, and Shlomo's Medina, Shlomo's country, is in white. And you can see that it is, triple, even quadruple the size of modern-day Israel. And the borders are actually the borders that Hashem promises Moshe will be the borders of Eretz Yisrael back when he is on Har Nevo about to die. And Moshe requests to enter the land, and Hashem says, no, you can't, but I'll let you see it. And so Moshe goes, and we're told that Hashem shows him the land from Nahar Prat. And we know that, Eretz Yisrael doesn't really go up to the Nahar Prat, but it did in the time of Shlomo HaMelech. Hashem was showing Moshe all of Eretz Yisrael in the totality of history, according to Rashi, and this is perhaps what he is referring to. So we're all the way up at Nahar Prat, all the way down to Eilat, even into the Sinai Desert from today, and obviously to the Mediterranean Sea. More important even than the size of the land that Shlomo conquered. And by the way, this doesn't mean that Am Yisrael lived in all of this land. It's not that they ventured all the way north to Nahar Prat. They didn't actually settle there. All it means is that they conquered those peoples, and in deference to their new sovereign, those people had to pay taxes to Shlomo HaMelech. So it was actually both a sense, it gave him the sense both of political security, military security, and that these were now under his reign and they would not fight against him because they were now under him, but also economic prosperity because they would now pay him taxes and it would just help bring all the money in that he would need for his kingdom. The third area of prosperity is that of food. We're told about all the food and even the animals that Shlomo had. And this is really symbolic of economic security. We're told specifically that the people were ochlim v'shotim u'smichim. They were not only physically nourished, but they were emotionally satisfied, as Shira mentioned before. Right? They were thriving really both physically and emotionally. And in Perakei Pasakei, we're told that each man in Bnei Yisrael sat peacefully tachat gafno, ish tachat gafno v'tachat te'inato. Each man sat under his fig tree, and under his grapevine and under his fig tree. As we all know, do we need figs and grapes to live? I don't even like figs, and I'm alive, right? So obviously we don't need figs and grapes to live. So what does it mean that each man was sitting under his fig tree and grapevine?
Extra.
Good. Right? It's a symbol of luxury. It's a symbol of going above and beyond the bare necessities. What is the bare necessity? What do we need to live? bread and water. Right? And here, each man and each individual has a fig tree and a grapevine to sit under, which shows us, again, the sense of security, the sense of specifically economic security that they all had, that they were experiencing luxury and wealth and above and beyond what was necessary. The fourth point of abundance, and I'll go over them at the end, are horses and chariots, right? Which means, by the way, that Shlomo had a nice-sized army, right? Cavalry. We can't ignore the fact that this was actually Usher. The king has a limit to the amount of horses he is allowed to have based on Zivar and Perek Yud Zion. Shlomo exceeded that limit, but it's still important. I'm not ignoring that. That's just not what we're dealing with today. He is punished for it, and it's likely, well, Chazal say that it was one of the causes of his downfall and why his son lost the Malucha of the other 10 tribes, etc. But what is important to point out for our purposes today is that he had a very nice-sized army. Not because he was being attacked from other places, he really achieved peace with his neighbors. But remember, he could only have expanded his borders that far with an army. So he definitely had a very nice-sized army. And finally, the fifth area of abundance, which is noted in Malachim Aleph, is Shlomo's wisdom. And the story behind this is even more fascinating than the wisdom itself, because how did Shlomo receive this wisdom? How did he become so brilliant that everyone in the world wanted to hear from him? But Hashem comes to him as soon as he becomes king, and he offers him anything in the world that he wanted, kind of like a genie in the bottle, right? But instead of three wishes, he got one. And Shlomo could have asked for anything, for wealth, for personal happiness, for health. No. But what did he ask for? He asked for wisdom. And the reason why he explains he wanted that wisdom was so that he can have a lev shomea l'shvoda ta'am hazeh. It was for the benefit and the purpose of helping his people, so he could judge his nation wisely and fairly. And so here we not only see Shlomo's wisdom being in abundance, but it's almost like his wisdom is a symbol of his leadership, of his able leadership, of his love for his people, and how, as Chana Reisel explained before, his name had spread throughout the known world at the time, and everyone wanted to hear from him. Everyone wanted to learn from him. Now, because of all the economic abundance and political security and peace and prosperity that we've been discussing, what was Shlomo now ready to do? What was the next project in his life? It's not on the sheet. Does anyone know, though? What is Shlomo most famous for? Building the Beit HaMikdash. And right after this discussion, we are told that Shlomo wants to build the Beit HaMikdash, and immediately after the psukim I gave you, he gets in touch with Chiram Melech Tzur, and he starts asking him for wood, because they have skilled wood choppers. Bnei Yisrael didn't have that skill yet, and he starts the process of building the Beit HaMikdash. Now, the Beit HaMikdash building occurs over the next three prakim. So we just did Perek Hay inside. Bav, Zayin, and Chet are all dedicated to Binyan Bayit Rishon. And we're told how beautiful it was and how luxurious and full of grandeur it was. And it took 7 years to build. 7 years. That's a long time to build a home. Now, granted, this is in ancient times, but I still think it was a very long time. He took a lot of care, and he wanted to make sure everything was perfect. Fast forward 40 prakim and 400 years later, and we come to the very end of Malchut Yehuda. And we're given a very, very different portrait of the same nation, obviously not the same king, but the same kingdom, right? And the same land. And here, Melachim Bet, at the end of Melachim Bet, the second source in your packet, we're told about the last king of Malchut Yehuda, whose name is Tzidkiyahu. Tzidkiyahu follows a series of three terribly evil kings. His father, Yoshiyahu, was actually a tzaddik, and he instituted an entire tshuva reformation, and he totally and completely rebelled from his own father, Menashe, who was the worst king. During Menashe's time, the decree of the Horban, or the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, was actually decreed. Yoshiyahu then rebelled against his father and did a whole tshuva reformation, but unfortunately, his son Yehoahaz was instated, deposed after 3 months by Paro. Yehoiakim was then put into place. I believe I'm getting the order right. Yehoiakim was then put into place. Terrible, terrible, terrible king. Really, really, really bad. Really just made everyone in Bnei Yisrael scared of him, so they didn't want to do anything right because he just wanted them to do everything wrong from the perspective of Hashem. Then Yehoiakim took over his own son, Yehoiakim's son. Yehoiakim was exiled after 3 months during Galut Chereshu Masker, which we'll get to in a moment. And then Tzidkiyahu, who was Yehoyachin's uncle, so really Yehoyakim's brother, and Tzidkiyahu's, I meant Yoshiyahu's son, I'm sorry, I don't have like a big chart to make this clear. But Tzidkiyahu was the last king, because during his 11th year, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. But just to give you a sense of what was going on during this time period, during all of these kings that I mentioned, Yoshiyahu, Yehoahaz, Yehoyakim, Yehoyachin, and Tzidkiyahu, Yirmiyahu was the Navi, the main Navi, not the only Navi, but the main Navi. And Yirmiyahu was sent by Hashem to give B'nai Yisrael at the time many, 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 many Nevuot, primarily in the spiritual realm and in the political realm. In the spiritual realm, Yirmiyahu's message, well, he had a lot of messages, but one of his main rebukes of B'nai Yisrael was that they were listening to the Nevi'i Sheker. The Nevi'i Sheker, the false prophets, were trying to convince B'nai Yisrael that it didn't matter what they did at home, as long as they came to the Beit HaMikdash and brought karbanot, as long as they offered sacrifices to God, they could do whatever they want. They could worship other gods in their free time, as long as it was in their houses and not in the Beit HaMikdash. Now, because Yoshiyahu and Chizkiyahu before him completely destroyed all the bamot, any other way of worshiping God or bringing karbanot to Hashem, the only way to worship Hashem was in the Beit HaMikdash. And so the people did this very faithfully, to the point that Hashem tells Yirmiyahu, I don't want their karbanot. I don't want their karbanot if they're just going to go home and bring some other karban to another god. If they're going to be worshiping another god, I don't want what he gives me. Right? And I mean, a mashal used to understand this is if a wife, chas v'shalom, finds out that her husband is having an affair, she doesn't want any gift that he's going to give her. It's meaningless. No matter how expensive that necklace is, it's meaningless if it doesn't represent something genuine. And so Yirmiyahu tells the people, stop. Right? Stop thinking that as long as you hide in the Beit HaMikdash and bring karbanot, you'll be protected, and that you could do whatever you want outside. That's not how it works. That was Yirmiyahu's, one of his main rebukes of B'nai Yisrael in the spiritual realm. His rebuke to B'nai Yisrael in the political realm was a little bit more shocking. Hashem told Yirmiyahu to tell Tzidkiyahu and the people that they should submit to Bavel. They should not rebel. They should not try to fight back for their own sovereignty. They should let Bavel take over. Can you imagine if Netanyahu gets up and says, okay, Iran wants to take over, we're just going to let them take over our government, we're going to step down, and Iran's going to take over. I don't know about you, but that wouldn't sit so well with me. It wouldn't sit so well with many of us. So here we can, you know, almost understand, even though it was against Ritzon Hashem, why B'nai Yisrael, why Tzidkiyahu wanted to fight and wanted to keep their sovereignty. It almost seems like, how can I give up my national pride? But what Hashem promised them through Yirmiyahu was that if they submitted, they would actually remain in their land. If they submitted, the whole Bavel thing would go away and they'd regain their sovereignty. If they just held still for 70 years. Now, that's a long time because Tzidkiyahu himself would die probably before he'd be able to be king. However, in the long run, Hashem said, just hold still and then you'll keep everything as is. But instead, as you read in the beginning of source number 2, Tzidkiyahu decides to rebel against Babylonian sovereignty. What does that mean? He stopped paying his taxes. When a nation conquers a foreign nation and they don't want to actually, you know, move their people there, they just kind of want to keep them under their sovereignty, that conquered nation pays a tax, a mas. And when the nation stops paying the taxes, then the foreign, you know, conquerors go in to set things straight. Yeah.
So this are already in the 70 years?
Like, no, not at all. The 70 years are from the Chorban until this is right before.
Okay.
Exactly. This is right before. It's actually in his 9th year, and the Chorban is in his 11th year. So it's basically a year and a half before the Chorban. He decides, well, probably more like 2 or 2.5 years before the Chorban, because things happen slowly in the ancient days. Because Melech Bavel had conquered them years before, and they just had to pay a tax in order to keep him at bay. For him to retain his sovereignty, they only had to pay a tax. And Hashem said, keep doing that, and you'll be fine. But he said no. Everyone in the nation wanted to rebel against Tzidkiyahu. They wanted to create a coalition amongst all of them so that maybe they'd have a chance. So Tzidkiyahu rebels. And what happens is, things happen a little slowly in the ancient Near East, but by the time Bavel came, it was the 9th year of Tzidkiyahu, and he besieges Yerushalayim, as you've read. And in the rest of the Perek, we're given a description of what life was like during that siege. On Asar Batevi, that's why we fast on Asar Batevi, the siege began. And it lasted until they were able to finally break through the walls, because they broke B'nai Yisrael down so badly They were so starving and so weak that they couldn't defend themselves anymore. And so during Horeb Bayit Rishon, this actually happened on Tet Tammuz, the ninth of Tammuz, that they broke through the wall. It's Horeb Bayit Sheni, in which the walls are broken on Shavuos Arba Tammuz, which is why we fast today on Shavuos Arba Tammuz, because it was more recently. So for a year and a half, from Teveit till the following Tammuz, Bnei Yisrael are under siege. And it's quite interesting the way that the circumstances of Bnei Yisrael during this time are described. And again, I'd like to explain it in terms of the five abundances that we were told about in Shlomo HaMelech's time. So in terms of the people, we're not told this explicitly in the Psukim, but if you know anything about Bnei Yisrael's history, you know that the people we're dealing with right now in Malchut Yehuda are a tiny fraction of the people who are under Shlomo HaMelech's kingdom. Because Shlomo HaMelech ruled all 12 Shvatim. Now we're only, right, the 10 Shvatim were already exiled by Ashur 200 years before, so we're back down to only two of those Shvatim. But we already mentioned during Malchut Yehoyachin, Bavel had already taken most of the people in Malchut Yehuda to Bavel. All the skilled laborers, all the soldiers, all the nobility, all the royal family, all the leaders, and Chazal say all the Talmidei Chachamim. So basically, who was left? The poorest of the poor. The people who to Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't be able to cause a rebellion, wouldn't be able to band together, had no leadership skills, wouldn't be able to do anything to him. So who's left right now at the time of this siege? Practically no one, right? A fraction of what once was. And coming to our second abundance at the time of Shlomo HaMelech, in terms of the land and the size of the land that Shlomo had conquered, again, not exactly referenced in the Pesukim, but very, very clear if you know the knowledge, if you just read through all of Sefer Melachim, because we're only in Malchut Yehuda now, which is the southern kingdom, which is already a tiny fraction of the land, and we are really only hearing about one city, about Yerushalayim. Not that there weren't other cities in Malchut Yehuda, but we're only being told about one city, about Yerushalayim. And even more so, again, remember what we spoke about, the size of Shlomo's land wasn't as much about the land itself, but about the fact that he was receiving taxes, about the fact that there was peace with, you know, in all the at all the borders. And here it's the exact opposite, right? Instead of Bnei Yisrael receiving taxes from foreign nations, now Bnei Yisrael are paying taxes to a foreign nation who has sovereignty over them. So they've completely lost basically almost everything that they had gained in Shlomo's time. What about food? So here is where your sources come into play. Because what are we told about food? Not only were there no gefen uteina, but there was hardly any
bread,
right? V'lechem lo haya ba'aretz. V'lo haya lechem ba'aretz. Not only were they lacking in luxury at this point, but they were lacking even the basic necessities. The famine was so, so severely terrible that we're told in Eicha from the same Yirmiyahu who wrote Sefer Melachim, that Bnei Yisrael starved so badly that they lost their moral compass. Let's turn for a moment to source number 3. In Eicha Perek Dalet, Pasuk Dalet, we're told first how bad the suffering was during the famine. Davak l'shonu neg el chiko betzama. You have a nursing infant. All he needs is milk from his mother. And you know, a mother can be starving and still produce some milk. The mother has to be really starving not to even have enough milk to give to her son or daughter. And now the nursing baby was so parched that his tongue was stuck to the roof of his mouth. Olalim sha'alu lechem. Young babies, right, older than nursing infants, those who were weaned already, they asked for bread, pores ein lechem, but there wasn't even a slice to give them. And so what happens during desperate times? Unfortunately, when people are lacking in nutrition, really we know that things happen to people's brains. They can't think logically. They can't think things through. And the most horrific description of the time of the Beit HaMikdash is told to us in Eicha Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud, Yedei Nashim Rachmaniyot Bishlu Yaldehen. The hands of merciful women cooked their own children. Hayu Livarot Lamo, and they became their food, Beshever Bat Ami. This was the food of the nation, their own children, which is terrible and horrific, and we hope that even if this happens to us, the famine part, we would never stoop to this level. It is so terrible. And Yirmiyahu tells it as it is because he wants us to understand what was going on, what was really happening. And in Eicha, and we'll get there hopefully towards the end, but in Eicha, Yirmiyahu really does a very good job at illustrating exactly what the destruction was like. The period of time leading up to it, and also the period of time, its period of time, and then following as well. Okay, so far we have three areas of abundance from Shlomo HaMelech's time that here, you know, that reached its height in Shlomo HaMelech's time, and we see during Tzidkiyahu's time have reached the absolute low. right? The amount of people in the population, the amount of land that they had, and in terms of their peace that was lacking, and their food. In terms of the horses and chariots, so here we spoke about how this is really referring to the army. This is really referring to their soldiers. What happened to the soldiers of Bnei Israel as soon as the Bavlim broke through the walls? So I don't know if you looked at Mitzudat David, but Mitzudat David explains, Ratzel Omar, okay, so let's just turn for a moment. I'll show you it inside. Let's turn for a moment to Perek Chaf Hey, Pasuk, hold on, Pasuk Dalet. In Pasuk Dalet, we're told that Tibaka Ha'ir, the wall was infiltrated, V'chol Anshei HaMelchama Halayla, and all the men of the war at night. What does that mean? So if you turn to the Mitzvah David, in the middle of page 3, Ratzalomar Barchu Balayla. The army deserted. They were so weak, they couldn't even defend their people, but they didn't even try. So we're talking about Shlomo, who had an amazing, amazing army, and now Tzidkiyahu's own army deserted. They couldn't even defend their nation. Loss of national pride. Is that a question? Okay. And then finally, right, the abundance of Shlomo Melech's wisdom, which symbolized his leadership, here we see that Tzidkiyahu did the exact opposite, right? Shlomo Melech loved his people so. He requested wisdom to help them, and he represented them to all the other nations. Here's the exact opposite. What does Tzidkiyahu do as soon as the Bavlim come? Does he stay and try to lead his people? Does he stay and show, you know, okay, Bavlim, take me, but, you know, you're going to take my people, take me first? No. What Tzidkiyahu does is he runs away. He had built himself a private tunnel, and he ran away, hoping to escape, and in the process, completely abandoned his people. Not exactly able leadership, not exactly a love for his people. Right? And so we see that the heights that Shlomo HaMelech reached, which you should know, by the way, that Yimot HaMashiach are compared to the times of Shlomo HaMelech. These were the heights of Bnei Israel's existence. Now we see in the times of Tzidkiyahu, they've lost all that. They've lost all that, and they've experienced every single point of abundance in its lowest point. All this paved the way for the ultimate climax of the destruction, which is obviously Chorban Beit Rishon, Chorban Beit HaMikdash, the destruction. But now I want to just ask you guys a question. Was the Chorban of the Beit HaMikdash just about the Beit HaMikdash? When we mourn on Tisha B'Av, are we mourning only the wood and the stones and the kalim that were in the Beit HaMikdash that were then destroyed? So in order to answer this question, I'm going to ask you another question. Some of you were like 2 when this happened, and some of you were older. Okay, but let me ask you this question. When the World Trade Center was destroyed by 9/11, and you guys may not know this from personal experience, but you've probably heard about it, right? Was it just about some molten steel and broken glass? No, of course not. What was it about? What was so horrific about 9/11?
All the people who died.
Okay. Right. First and foremost, it was all the lives that were lost. Right. Thousands and thousands of lives, innocent lives that were lost for no reason. Yeah.
I think it's like the symbolism behind it.
Okay. Meaning?
Like, it's showing that we're bringing America to a rail. Like, we're touching something that's untouchable. We're fighting with the essence of America.
Absolutely. And do you know what were the other two targets of Al-Qaeda that day?
So it was
World Trade Center, which they hit. It was the Pentagon, which they hit. And it was the Capitol, which they did not, only because of some brave passengers on United Flight 93 who basically took over the cockpit and rammed the plane into the ground so that they wouldn't kill anyone else in the process. There's a whole movie about it, apparently. I think I might have seen it. I don't remember. Yes. So yes, first and foremost, it was about all the lives lost, and not at all to... make that or to belittle that in any way, but I agree that it's also a little bit beyond that because Al-Qaeda had a message that they were trying to convey. Why do you think that they specifically targeted the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the Capitol? What does each one represent?
Finance, yeah.
Good.
Defense.
Good.
And the people running the country.
Very good. Al-Qaeda very purposefully targeted finance, freedom of economics, right? Our free world, capitalism. They targeted the powerful military of this country, and they targeted democracy. Everything about the West that they hate, they wanted to destroy. And therefore, they chose specific buildings to convey that message. And so we see that the destruction of a building is hardly ever limited to steel and glass or wooden stones that are falling down or melting or shattered. It's a lot of times above and beyond that. What did the Beit HaMikdash represent? Why was it so utterly devastating that we lost the Beit HaMikdash?
It represents God.
Okay. It represents Bnei Yisrael's connection to God. Right, what are we told in Devarim Perek Yud-Bet? We're told HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem is the only place that you can worship Hashem in. Only one place. We're not told what it is yet. We're just told that Hashem will choose it and tell us later. And we're not allowed to worship Him anywhere else. And as we discussed, even as the Churban was approaching, they weren't worshiping Hashem anywhere else. They were only worshiping Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash. Yeah, okay, they were worshiping other gods also, but they were also worshiping Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash. They knew that Judaism was about that. So Bnei Yisrael at the time, the Beit HaMikdash was more than just a building that Shlomo had built. It was who they were. It was their identity. It was their religion. Mrs. Yael Leibowitz actually says that the Beit HaMikdash was the center of their ritualistic religion. It's where they brought their karbanot. It was everything to them. In hindsight, we know that Judaism survived, and we can say even thrived without the Beit HaMikdash. Right? We're here in a Beit Midrash, right next to a Beit Knesset. We know that there are other centers of Judaism that are important and can help Judaism survive and even thrive. But back then, they didn't have that. There was not a Beit Midrash. Well, maybe there was a place for learning Torah. I shouldn't say that. But there was no Beit Knesset. They could only do that kind of thing in the Beit HaMikdash itself. And so when the Balaam destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, it wasn't just the Beit HaMikdash that they destroyed. They destroyed our temple, and with it, our identity. Right? They destroyed our king, and with it, our leadership. They destroyed our land. They ripped us away from our land. And with it, our society. Day-to-day living, everything we knew was completely gone. And so as we're mourning the loss of the Beit HaMikdash on Tisha B'Av, we're really mourning more than that. It's not just a building that we're mourning. And I'd like to even suggest that what Yirmiyahu is showing us and teaching us through paralleling the heights of Shlomo HaMelech with the depths of Tzidkiyahu HaMelech, he's really pointing out that we're mourning for the loss of five things. The people, the Bnei Yisrael, were murdered and killed during the Churban. It wasn't just about the Beit HaMikdash, right? The picture I showed you at the front also of the Sorshi, I did it on purpose to show that there were people there. Right? We always think sometimes, oh, yeah, the Beit HaMikdash was in flames. Then we think everyone just walked away to Bavel. But that's not how it happened. Those who were kept alive after the entire thing walked away to Bavel. But it wasn't that simple. People were very much killed in the process, including Tzidkiyahu's sons, and then his eyes were gouged out. So the last image he carried with him for the rest of his life was the murder of his sons. So that was number one, right? The people. The loss of the people are what we're mourning, right? Their loss, their murder, but also even their exile. And that connects to the land, that they were torn away from the land that was promised to them from Hashem in the most shameful way by their enemies. Remember, the land, the abundance of land before was also that we were sovereign over other people. And now we're being conquered by others. In terms of the food, right? And remember, this is really symbolic of economic security. And with it, with the economic security that Bnei Yisrael lost, they lost their moral compass. And so we're mourning the loss of the people. We're mourning the loss of their land, the loss of their economic security and moral compass in terms of the food. What does the army symbolize? National pride, self-defense, the ability to take care of oneself. Completely gone. And again, the king's wisdom, we lost leadership. We lost our king. We lost Malchut Beit David. And so it is this complete and total loss, and especially its contrast to what once was, that Yirmiyahu mourns. Yes, he mourns what happened, but he wants to sharpen it for us who weren't there by contrasting it to everything that came before. And he did this, as we saw in Sefer Melachim, and he also did this in Sefer Eicha. It's 9 o'clock, so I'm not going to go through the entire parak, or half the parak that I gave you, but I do want to at least read one or two psukim, if that's okay. So if you turn to Eicha Parak Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, we're told, Eicha yashva badad ha'ir rabati am. How is it possible that the city that was once full of people is now sitting alone? This contrast between what was and what is. Haita ka'amana rabati bagoyim. The city that was so great amongst the other nations is now like a widow. Right? She has lost her beloved, her people. Sarati ba'medinot haita lamas. She, who was once ruling over other countries, right, think Shlomo HaMelech, is now being taxed, is now being ruled over by those other countries. Let's go to Pasuk Daled. Bless you. Darchit Zion Avelot Mibli Ba'eim Oed. Right, in the olden days, even a few months before, people were going, traveling the pathways of Yerushalayim to get to the Beit HaMikdash on the Shalosh Regalim, on the holidays. Now they're empty. Kol She'areh HaShomemin, all of her gates are desolate. Kohaneha Ne'anachim, her Kohanim, her priests are sighing. Betuloteha, new goat, her virgins are full of sorrow. Vihi Marla, and she is bitter. And finally, in Pasuk Zayin, where I think that the contrast is strongest, Zachra Yerushalayim Yimei Anya Umerudeha, Yerushalayim, during her days of poverty, during her days of rebellion, she remembered Kol Machamudeha Asher Hayu Mimei Kedem, all of the beautiful things that she used to have in ancient times. But now, right, Benfol Amma Biyad Sar, but now she, her nation has fallen to the hands of the enemy, Ve'ein Ozerla, and there's no one to help her. Ra'uha tsarim sachaku amishvateha. Right, we skipped another pasuk that says that her old friends have now become her enemies. And I believe that it's through this study of contrast that Yirmiyahu is really able to teach us how we're supposed to mourn on Tisha B'Av and what we're supposed to mourn for. In order to understand what we've lost, we have to first understand what it once was. So I hope that this year on Tisha B'Av we are not having going to have to read Eicha. I hope that we're all together in Yerushalayim in all of its grandeur, as Yirmiyahu has so beautifully explained to us. But just in case that doesn't happen, I hope that we're better able to appreciate what we're missing. Yes.
Can you just repeat quickly the five things?